Okay, hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today in our podcast session by Adele Visa from Index Exchange, Country Manager. Is that your job title, Adele?
That's correct, yes.
Excellent. And I'm going to have to make mention of the fact that we're recording this week's podcast in sunny Sydney. I get a lot of hassle from the team back at HQ about sort of rustling up an Australian ad tech mafia to get onto the podcast. And this time I thought I'd go that one step further and come all the way to Sydney to get the Australian edge.
Perfect time of year to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think they're all quietly thinking I'm not actually doing any work, so this is also good evidence that I am doing work. Awesome. Well, anyway, it's great to have you here today. Let's get started on our news stories. I've kind of grouped them under themes this week to help us guide our discussion. And just because there's so much going on underneath these themes, I just thought it was an opportunity to sort of unearth a couple of articles, more than just the regular three that we look at. So the first theme is Facebook competition, an article appearing in Recode, I think, late last week about Amazon's ad business set to double in the US in 2019, and that actually advertisers are stating that they're ready to pull advertising dollars away from Facebook, stating privacy concerns, which is a fairly bold statement. And I thought that was a nice little read across together with an article on a new site called The Information, which we actually featured a little bit in a sort of, you know, what to think about in 2019 article on Exchangeware a couple of weeks ago, on China's ByteDance, who are really getting a very big share of market in India and Southeast Asia, a growing share of market in India and Southeast Asia, and how they're tipped to be some competitors, rather competitive Facebook in that region, doing the same thing, clawing ad dollars away from Facebook in that India, Southeast Asia region. So my question here is, do you think that 2019 is going to be the year that we're actually going to see some serious competition to Facebook? Are advertisers actually going to start shifting their budgets? And I guess the follow-on from that as well is two things. Are we really going to see Asian companies coming to the forefront as viable competitors to these massive big tech platforms? And what is this move, advertisers kind of shifting their dollars away from Facebook? What's that saying about things like transparency and accountability?
Mm-hmm. I think you absolutely nailed it. Like, it is that theme of transparency being demanded on both extremes of the ecosystem. So, you know, the end clients or the users of these websites are acutely aware of what they're, or are becoming more and more aware, if they're not already, of what they're giving up when they're using some of these platforms and some of the risks. Obviously, the high profile cases that happened in 2018 around Facebook's privacy concerns and the data that was leaked or used without people's knowledge. You know, that's kind of making, users a little bit more vigilant about what they're agreeing to when they're signing up to platforms. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's obviously the end advertisers are demanding this greater transparency in the ecosystem to know, you know, what's being or what they're actually buying and how they're buying it and at what point in the value chain are certain things coming into play and things like that. So it's definitely, it's a theme of a lot of our conversations we're having, not only just with publishers around, you know, GDPR that came out last year as well. Obviously, given that it's European, doesn't have a massive impact in Australia, and due to our consumer privacy laws that we have in place already, you know, we don't, we're sort of a little bit more stitched up from a protection point of view down here. But, you know, that's obviously going to become more and more of a theme, and you know, publishers and advertisers are trying to navigate how they play in that space.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems interesting to me that we've spent a lot of time kind of talking about this, particularly since the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal in 2018, you know, with lots of people saying, oh, it's got to be the kind of tipping point. It's got to be the point at which perhaps driven in the first instance by users, because we know, for example, that, you know, user numbers for Facebook in the US are definitely plateauing. In Europe, they're backing off. And, you know, I hear anecdotally from, you know, millennials that we have in the office, youngsters, and actually also from people like my nieces and nephews who are much younger, sort of in the teenage category, they have really strong views about their use of Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. They actually have very strong opinions about protecting their data and privacy, which surprised me.
Yeah.
And so we talked about this a lot in 2018, but I guess I'm wondering, is 2019 going to be the year that we're actually going to start to see that shift? Because oftentimes in fast-moving industries, tech-related industries, and also in, you know, the world of advertising and marketing, we talk about things and talk about things and talk about things, mm-hmm. and then it just sort of feels like suddenly something changes, a light switch goes on or off,
yep.
and then there's a bit of an avalanche towards a new world.
Absolutely. I do feel completely out of touch with that sort of stuff as well, because, you know, I use Facebook very sporadically, and my nephew, who's 11, was like, won't even touch it and uses Snapchat with his mates and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's a different form of communication for the end users. But from an industry point of view, I definitely think there is going to be a shift. As to how quickly that happens, I'm not overly sure.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at the drivers and how the industry moves. And it is predominantly like advertiser-led. So from an education point of view, I think we'll start to see the shift when there is greater education around what that actually means and how, you know, if an advertiser is trying to still deliver their goals and their, you know, achieve their acquisition, signups, whatever that end objective might be, how they do that through other means. Because at the moment, you know, Facebook is for many a known entity.
Yeah.
They know how to deliver against it and they know how it performs and the strategies that they need to employ in order to achieve those objectives. So if there's greater education around other channels that can provide, you know, the ability to target those audiences at the same scale potentially, or, you know, another factor, then we'll start to see the shift happen a little bit more readily. But it is an education piece.
Yeah, I think you're right. That is a really important point, because we hear time and time again from advertisers and marketers that they use it because it's easy and because mm-hmm. it gets some results, right?
Yep.
And that hasn't changed. And certainly that's what, you know, like I said, when we've been having these conversations in 2018, that was the sort of bottom line that we kept coming back to. Well, it's not going to make a difference until the platform stops sort of delivering, as it were, and what will be the market drivers that might potentially make that happen. Interestingly, in our sort of, you know, what we're going to be focused on in 2019 piece that Kieran wrote a couple of weeks ago, he also said that he felt that, you know, the dominant platforms in our industry were going to get some challenge this year, but it was going to be from other big tech companies or Chinese companies. And I guess that's why that ByteDance example is really interesting, right?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I think if you look at some of the markets in Asia, they have really rich technology ecosystems. And, you know, it has traditionally been focused inwards on the market. And what they're starting to do now is look at how they take that and make it more global as a platform. So I would not be surprised at all if in 2019 we started to see those, you know, bigger players potentially, you know, like out of China, start to really scale up and take it more globally. Once they have, and I think if you look at how global we are as a world,
yes.
from a user base point of view as well,
yeah.
Like the scalability becomes easier because we're not sort of, you know, limited to just targeting a particular demographic in a particular market.
No, we're really a global community, really,
absolutely,
aren't we?
Yeah.
It's so interesting. It's a bit of that's a helpful segue into second news item, which is Amazon's growth. It just feels like, you know, we sort of, these are the topics that we constantly, one leads on to the other.
Yes.
Just it'll be interesting to imagine a world when that doesn't happen. Amazon's growth. And that follows on a little bit from what we've just been talking about. An article in the Economic Times of India about continued growth for Amazon Prime in that region, in India specific, because they're launching two additional languages to their regional content. I think it was Gujarati and Punjabi, and they already offer content in five local languages. But that's seen as, you know, an effort, an Amazon Prime effort to compete directly with Netflix and I think it's Hotstar, who are owned by Star India, to kind of get some of the share of that video streaming market.
Yeah.
And then in addition to that, The Hollywood Reporter wrote last week about Amazon-owned IMDb launching a new free-to-access video-supported streaming service, giving you access to TV and movies called FreeDive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, what's interesting about that is it's, you know, two instances of Amazon growth. I'm interested in the notion of them launching an ad-supported model, which is what Freedive is, in addition to their subscription model, because we also spend a lot of time talking about whether the subscription streaming sort of market is tapped out. How many subscriptions can you afford to have in the household? And then I'm also interested in this from the APAC perspective, because it's Amazon looking to India, which is the next big APAC giant, really, after China, to establish themselves. And I'm just wondering how critical to Amazon's growth is that APAC expansion, because, you know, how much further can they get in the US and in other English-speaking markets?
Yep.
And it's really interesting, I think, to have a look at the sort of tactics that they're employing to get share of that market, actually tailoring content in local languages. So,
for sure.
Yeah, really interested in your views on that.
It's I'm not going to claim to know everything about the video market.
Why not, Adele? surely on top of all the other things you're doing, you've got time to become an expert in online streaming video, no?
I consume a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes us experts in our own way.
It does. Yeah. I'm definitely vintage in the programmatic ecosystem, but video is still a
new.
It is. It's the one thing that keeps me entertained at the moment and growing my education base. So I think, to that point around, global platforms playing locally, it's going to be interesting, I think, when you look at how many of these players are changing their business models to take that on. We have, I think, in Australia, in APAC, one of the most competitive OTT video markets in the world.
So I was interested to know about that. What's happening here in Australia? What's Amazon's share of market like in Australia?
So zilch. From a video point of view, actually, I don't know what the exact number is, but I know Netflix has obviously been one of the most dominant players. We've had a subscription model in the market for a number of years with Foxtel. The free-to-air TV stations have obviously built their catch-up solutions as well. So I think one of the difficulties we had as a country, it was actually just connectivity and our
infrastructure.
Correct. Which is...
Let's not have an NBN conversation.
No, oh my gosh, I don't even want to touch on that. They've broken the phone line at my house 3 times in the last 18 months trying to fix it, and we still don't have NBN. So I'm on ADSL, which is a lot of fun, especially when you work in tech.
I mean, I have to say, Adele, I'm surprised that, when Index hear this podcast, they're going to be like, we need to get down there to sort this out.
It's a running joke internally. When everyone comes down, it's like,
Adele's on dialogue.
Yeah, it's good to see you guys. Haven't got your NBN yet. It's
kind of out of step. Sorry, not to sort of segue, but it's kind of out of step with everything else that happens in Australia, don't you think? Because I know as a country, we've definitely got some infrastructure challenges, massive country, relatively small population in comparison to the size of the country.
Yes.
So, you're talking about, the infrastructure challenges that go with that, but a very concentrated population around the southeastern seaboard. So why can't they get this right?
Yeah, anyway. I'm not even going to speculate on that one.
Yeah.
But it is a point of frustration. I think it's kind of held back a lot of the solutions from really being able to scale.
For sure.
Effectively.
Particularly in TV and video.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
If you look at how how much data is required to process a video and to then stream it and download it, etc. It's no wonder that it's taken us a little while, especially here. And obviously that's where I think APAC is sort of a more exciting opportunity for many of these companies, because there is a greater connectivity ability over there. Markets like India, South Korea, these are massive.
And I guess as well, if they've got the offering right and if they're sort of, targeting audiences in the right way, we know it's such a mobile heavy environment as well. So they're penetrating a population that are absolutely at the ready to consume via any device possible.
Yes.
So, you can see that the opportunity is massive for them there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What about the sort of subscription service versus ad supported? What's your view on that? Because I thought that was quite interesting, actually, because we're sort of all waiting for some of the other subscription services to launch ad supported models as well. And nobody's done it yet. So this looks like it's the first real effort by one of the big global players to say, yeah, we're gonna launch an ad supported model.
Yeah, I think there's definitely if I look at just even as close to home as like my group of friends and how many people have different subscription models set up, you know, I think there probably will be a capacity limit as to how many they would want to pay for. And if the content isn't valued to be unique enough for them, then they'll look elsewhere. Yeah. So if businesses have the ability to take on, you know, a different model that, you know, is seen by the user to be, you know, lesser cost or something that adds a different value exchange, that adoption will be there. I think time will tell, but
yeah,
depending on the market as well and the nature of the transaction.
Yeah.
Especially if you know, obviously we're very dominant in a lot of the immediate payment process from, you know, Apple's wallet. You can upload your credit cards and Google Pay and things like that.
Yep.
Is very strong here, but then you can go into like India and it's still very much a cash-based ecosystem.
Yeah. So you can imagine that being an environment where an ad-supported model
absolutely.
Is really popular.
Yeah, and yeah. I have to be honest, like I haven't been up to India in a number of years, but last time I was there, you know, we were trying to talk to eBay about the growth of their business in that market, and they found it difficult to scale because PayPal at the time wasn't even a thing.
Yeah.
Which was so foreign to me, like to hear it, because it was like, well, that's the main mode of transaction.
Yeah.
For me when I'm purchasing on eBay.
Yeah.
So how do I do this in a cash based system?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think
it's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that specifically, that actually it would just be an easier way for people to access content in mm-hmm. an environment where they just, you know, where they otherwise either don't have the money to pay for it or
yes.
it's not a convenient transaction. And that opens up the door to huge mm-hmm. potential for growth.
Yeah. And I think that's that value that people want in the video space, right? Or yeah. the connected TV space.
Yeah.
You still want the ability to watch, like to choose the time that you're watching your show.
Yeah.
And that for me with a young kid who's constantly keeping me active when he's awake, that's my value. That's where I, you know, that's when I'm looking for a provider, I'm looking for that value exchange. Like I want to know the content that you have and I can consume it at the right time that I want to consume it.
Control the environment.
Correct.
Yeah.
And there's definitely been, that example you just gave was spot on. You know, we had, it was actually ABC iView where they were back, they had back channel. Oh, sorry. What's the word I'm looking for?
Back catalog.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. The back catalog for one of the particular shows that we just happened to watch on free to air at the time, and got absolutely hooked. And, you know, that, you know, from a, you know, linear TV experience through to a catch up TV experience. Yeah. Fantastic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, I think one of the reasons they don't do it on, you know, BBC's catch-up services because they've got really complex licensing, royalties arrangements as well with talent.
Yeah.
And so there's a very limited back catalogue. In fact, there isn't one.
Yeah.
So I guess the way that they arrange it is by then selling their series onto or licensing their series mm-hmm. onto Netflix or Amazon Prime or
yeah.
other international yeah. sort of stations.
Yeah.
Fascinating world that. I have a feeling that we're all going to be talking a lot more about streaming and TV. I mean, you know,
yes.
we blithered on about a lot in 2018, mm-hmm. but it's another area that I think is going to become very, very real in 2019 in terms of growth for this industry, for advertising and marketing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing, and I don't know if you're aware of it, like Australia has one of the largest illegal downloads as
oh, really?
Well. Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Around Game of Thrones.
Ah, exposed here
yeah.
on the Mad Tech podcast.
And
yeah.
again, that's just based on, you know.
Access.
Correct. Yep. It's offered through a streaming service, but, you know, I guess people perceive that as potentially like cost prohibitive or, you know, don't necessarily want to sign up for a full package if they just want one particular show.
Thing.
And given how large Game of Thrones was as a brand, it didn't surprise me when I read that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. The cheeky Australians.
The cheeky Australians. Can always rely on them for a bit of criminal activity.
Yeah.
I say that with great fondness. Okay, well, actually, yeah, helpful segue into the third topic, privacy and regulation.
Yeah.
A New York Times article published recently covering a lawsuit that was brought forward by the City of LA against the Weather Channel, claiming improper use of customer data. So the allegation was that obviously you download a Weather Channel app and you have to give permission for the Weather Channel to access some of your data, mm-hmm. but they're not explicit about the ways in which they're using this data. And of course, surprise, surprise, they're using it for targeted marketing and they're also using it for hedge fund analysis.
Right.
And, you know, I can remember thinking a friend of mine's husband worked at a hedge fund many years ago, and I can remember him telling me about deals that were, you know, sort of immediately hooked onto predicting the weather. And I remember thinking that's got to be one of the worst things to be gambling on because the weather is so unpredictable. But, yes. you know, here we are many years later, and there's obviously a real business in trying to make it more and more and more predictable and, you know, bundling customer data into that. So, you know, the allegation being that this was improper use of customer data and they didn't make the customers aware of this.
Sure.
Then in conjunction with that, I also wanted to highlight a Fast Company article that came forward, I think it was last week, on Microsoft. And this is a really interesting article because it's basically quite an in-depth précis of where Microsoft's at in terms of how it's organised to deal with data privacy and regulation. And the article was putting forward facts such as, you know, Bill Gates being summoned to US Congress in the late 90s and early 2000s, having to justify how the company operates in light of, at the time, them achieving such commercial success in selling their software, their office software. Mm-hmm. And the argument being, is this not anti-competitive? So they had to really put a case forward to say, we're dominating, you know, we can admit that. But these are the ways in which we're organising our business to make sure that we're not anti-competitive. And they had to make some changes as a result of that, which has made them actually look relatively sophisticated and grown up when it comes to data privacy and dealing with government regulation in comparison to some of the other tech giants, you know, such as Google and Facebook and possibly even Amazon in the face of regulators. And I just thought that was a really interesting thing to sort of ponder and consider, because Microsoft are the kind of oldest kid on the block when it comes to those big tech companies. And this article highlights that they've actually put a lot of things in place, not just to make sure that they're complying, but also to make privacy and protecting customer data at the sort of heart of the way they do their business, which I thought was really interesting. And I was just interested in your views on this. I'd like to know a little bit about what the landscape is here in Australia. You already mentioned it, you know, but maybe you can say a little bit more about that when it comes to privacy and regulation. And I'm interested to also hear whether you think that any of this is going to be a sort of window in or an opportunity into the start of breaking up of some of these big tech companies in 2019 and beyond.
I think it's a fascinating space. Again, I'm not going to claim to know a lot about
the ins and outs
laws of legislation, etc.
GDPR legislation. You can't recite it, Adele. No.
I know what the acronym stands for.
Yeah, which is but good enough,
half
frankly.
The better one.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's a broader trend, right? Because we've seen it. It's come out in Europe with GDPR. We've also seen it in the States, in California. I believe whether it's happened or not, you know, it's meant to be under review in Canada as well. So there is a general, from a legislative point of view, an acknowledgement that, you know, the companies operating in this space haven't necessarily done, you know, the right things at all times. And so from a legislative point of view, there needs to be some changes to help protect the consumers. I mean, how many times have you been sent a terms of service document and you just click accept without reading
Absolutely.
All of those? I, even though I work in this space, I still do it, much to my husband's disgust. He's like, haven't you read the
Should
fine
you
print?
Read this?
Yeah. But who has time?
Yeah.
I guess you operate on the assumption that, you know, there is some sort of, you know, controls in place, but you don't know what those are. So this article obviously has highlighted the fact that you know, something has gone awry and consumers have been led astray, and they've not been operating in a way that has been
transparent.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that value exchange has been
mishandled.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. And sort of manipulative is actually what the lawsuit argues.
Right.
And it's interesting. It's interesting that's happened in LA as well, because we know that there is, you know, quite a bit of legislation that's being pushed through government, the Californian government, to try to put various regulations in place around privacy and control. You know, we obviously, you know, being based in London, we've spent a lot of time talking about GDPR and what the kind of, you know, fallout from that has been, which it so far has been very limited.
Yes.
But another thing that we think will become the obsession, not the obsession, but, you know, will definitely become a feature in 2019 is that someone will be made an example of, likely, in order for them to, if nothing else, at least test the legislation.
Yes.
Because I think what everybody was willing to accept, you know, even the government regulators themselves, is that the legislation hasn't, you know, isn't sophisticated enough to be applying penalties where those penalties ought to be applied, rather than actually making it harder for those in the value chain that ought not to be penalised.
Yes.
And it's you know, by proxy, giving a little bit more power and control to the dominant, already dominant platforms. Mm-hmm. So whatever is implemented needs over time to be tested so that it can be tweaked, and or needs to be, you know, well, in countries perhaps where there isn't legislation currently in place, it needs to be sort of crafted in a very thoughtful, artful way. So I guess that's why, because things aren't necessarily set in stone here in Australia. I know there is already legislation in place, but the ACCC released a report last year, didn't they, saying that they felt that there wasn't enough legislation applied to some of these big tech companies around data privacy and usage, but it was also relating to, you know, payment of taxes and things like that.
Sure.
But I'm just interested to hear your view on that. Do you think they've got things right here in Australia? What do you think's kind of going to happen next in the world of regulation?
I think we're all just sort of leaning in to it as well. You know, we, like you said, I think there is going to be one big example made. I know within the first week of the GDPR coming to fruition, there was a couple of cases or court cases that were raised.
Yep.
I didn't actually track them to see what the outcome was. But I agree. I don't think there's one clear, defined way to approach any of this, and it is going to be more of a consultative, iterative process that's going to happen across the board. So, you know, everyone was keeping eye on the European Union and what was happening with GDPR, and then we've sort of slowly seen more and more parties come to the table with, okay, we need to start thinking about this. What does it need to look like?
Yeah. And what about the angle of the sort of breakup of big tech? We know there's some really vocal supporters of this notion, you know, over in the US. Scott Galloway's constantly, you know, talking about the importance to democracy, to the democracies of the world, in making sure that some of these massive platforms don't continue to dominate. It's anti-competitive, but it's also just anti-democratic, is his argument.
Sure.
And he's been really explicit in stating that he doesn't think that the US government's in a position to really sufficiently legislate against that, and actually, you know, they'll be looking to the Europeans to sort of save the day, because the European Union can approach things from a slightly different way.
Yep.
What's the view over here in Australia about that? Do you sort of look on with interest? Are you thinking that it's something that's going to happen? Because I also imagine that if it does, if there is the breakup, legislative breakup of some of these companies, you know, Google or Facebook is instructed to spin off various elements of their companies into separate companies and change the management structure and stuff, I can imagine it's the sort of thing that's going to apply differently in different countries. So what's that going to look like?
That's a great question. I think it will happen. And, I mean, the question is, what happens first? Does the breakup happen, or is it actually that the competitive landscape changes so rapidly and that those businesses are now longer the ones that have the foothold? It's an interesting one if you look at how – you know, we sort of touched on it earlier. Some of these more regional players in APAC are bringing it to the global players, well, that we know from the more westernized world. So it's a question of, you know, is their business model going to be relevant by the time all this challenge comes to them? I think is the interesting question. And if you look at, you know, not to call out Facebook again, but if you look at their adoption rates, have been slowing up very dramatically over the last couple of years. You know, people are using other platforms to communicate, and that was kind of that key value proposition for Facebook in the very early days. So how do they evolve? You know, obviously they're still commanding a lot of market share from a spend point of view, which is where, you know, these conversations have come up as well. But, you know, from a user base, what a consumer's doing.
It's a good point, actually. You know, will the breakup precede just a natural market forces shifting things?
Yeah.
And that is that's fascinating because I think there's no two ways about the fact that we are already in the midst of, you know, we've said it before in this podcast and it comes up at our ATS events in Singapore, our regional event. This is the Asian century really, isn't it?
Yep.
And it's just a case of waiting to see how, we're at the start of it really.
Yeah.
It's just the case of waiting to see how some of those companies compete with a much wider landscape. As we mentioned earlier on, we know that a lot of Chinese countries are becoming very acquisitive outside of China because they just see such opportunity in Asia, elsewhere in Asia, closer to home. But there's no two ways about the fact that that is a prelude for looking at how they can roll things
and
out.
They're making small acquisitions in different markets. I mean, Tencent, which is obviously, you know, the Baidu, Alibaba and Tencent in China, they have an entity in Thailand.
Yeah.
They purchased a website over there called Sanook. And so they're now more of a global player as well. So I think we'll start to see more and more of a shift change there. And if you look at even just from an ad spend point of view, like APAC actually represents one of the largest regions globally. When you and typically you look at APAC as a mix of the markets. So if you're ever reading a report, it's typically like Australia and New Zealand and Japan and China. But when you look at it collectively, it's actually quite dominant.
Forceful market.
Exactly. Yeah. So if the change is coming from within, we should see that sort of expansion happening. I think Australia in some ways is sheltered. We are in so many ways literally on an island in the middle of nowhere.
Don't those of us that fly from one end of the world to the other to get here know all about that?
Yes.
It's so true.
Yeah. There was we had an internal event, I think it was March last year. I put up a slide that just showed that, you know, it takes us three and a bit hours to get to New Zealand, which is the same amount of time as someone in our UK office flying to Finland.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that our closest neighbour is, you know, what would be one of the furthest almost from our European operations is
it's quite eye-opening, isn't
it?
But so, yeah, what does that – so we're an island in the middle of nowhere. What do you think that does to –
Yeah, I think, you know, Australia, when we talk about like globalization of these Asian companies, we are some ways a little bit offset from that. We sit in the apex of the two. So we've got obviously the Western influence and the global platforms that are coming out of there, but then we've obviously got a very multicultural nation and we're going to get that adoption from those markets as well. So yeah, exactly. It's a really interesting vantage point.
For sure.
For here.
Yeah, fascinating. And the other thing I was thinking just as we were talking sort of slightly related but not was that I was reading a lot of stuff about CES in Vegas last week, I think it was, and they were talking about JD.com having a really impressive stand exhibiting their delivery drones. In addition to that, they also had a few other electronic gadgets which were mostly to do with logistics. And it's fascinating that that's a Chinese company, you know, showcasing that at a global tech show, but right in the heart of the US, and it's just—I don't know—I just think it's all everything's sort of pointing towards those companies just becoming much more of a force to be reckoned with outside of China.
Yeah,
it's really interesting, fascinating time to
watch
be
this
in
space.
Ad tech and martech. Absolutely. Okay, great. So now moving on to the next part of the session.
Yes.
Talk a little bit more about what Index are up to.
Yeah.
So say a bit more about perhaps what you're focusing on at Index at the moment here in Australia, New Zealand, and also globally.
Mm-hmm. I think for us the biggest focus, we have a few, but obviously the one that's kind of the leaning into a lot of these articles is around identity. And then obviously accountability and transparency are the other two
connected to that.
Yeah, and just continuous growth. You know, we're still a very young team on the ground here and you know, fairly new to the market. Obviously, I've only been with the business for about 18 months now, so still new in Australia and New Zealand and in broader APAC compared to a lot of our competitors.
Yeah.
So we're still establishing and, you know, educating the market around the value proposition and how Index is bringing solutions to clients that are going to help the ecosystem. So,
how many of you in the office here in Sydney?
We're nine now.
Yeah,
we have two open roles still, so it'll be 11.
Yep,
which is very exciting.
Yeah,
And we're servicing the APAC region from Australia. Okay. That includes Japan.
Yep. So you're country manager, but effectively this is the APAC HQ.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
So core focus Australia and New Zealand, obviously, because they're the most advanced markets from a header bidding point of view. And then Japan with our CCI partnership that we announced last year.
Yep.
And then into Southeast Asia as our sort of third focus, which is obviously a very big market on its own.
Absolutely. And when we were chatting before, just, you know, by way of prep, I suppose, getting back to the sort of, you know, core sort of business of Index, we were talking a little bit about auction mechanics as well.
Yes.
Yeah. There's some – tell us about your perspective on that at the moment.
Yeah.
What's kind of happening in the APAC market?
Yeah. It was – I think 2018 was like obviously a year of big change. You know, first price auctions became a thing. It was something that needed to happen for the market and for the ecosystem because second price, A, was never truly second price, and B, was broken in a waterfall in a, sorry, header bidding environment because your second price was not really indicative of your true demand. So obviously the first price shift has been that. And then there's been this greater theme in a lot of the conversations that are happening in market and a lot of the press in Australia and New Zealand, as well as in APAC, around transparency and accountability. And this is something that we continuously have conversations with our clients from the buy side all the way through to the publishers that we work with to ensure that, you know, we're making moves to give that transparency and to ensure that, you know, if an agency is talking to their end advertiser clients, they understand exactly where in that value chain fees are occurring or whatever it might be.
And, you know, it'd be remiss of me to not, you know, make mention of what everybody knows about, which is 2018 was a tough year in that department for Index. What have you learned from that? You know, if you were talking about transparency, accountability and so forth, what's been the learning point from that? What's shifted?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you kind of moving your gaze with respect to transparency and accountability?
Yeah, I think like as a business, it was a very humbling, humbling time for us. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we didn't really, and I assume we're talking about bid caching.
Yes.
So, you know, I think it definitely could have been handled in a number of different scenarios, but we didn't feel it was right to have anything other than a very honest and frank conversation with our partners and explain to them what had happened and what was built. There, unfortunately, I think is still a bit of a mist of gray around the actual mechanics themselves and how it worked. You know, we've spoken to all of our partners on both the buy and the sell side around how it actually was implemented, why it came to be, the value it derived. You know, it's an education piece that we've had to work through, but we needed to have that as a conversation as opposed to just, you know, blanket statements and things like that.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's,
in a way, it kind of sets the scene, doesn't it? For your ongoing relationship with clients.
Absolutely.
It makes that, I suppose, interaction, that relationship, client relationship, somewhat more mature.
Absolutely. And, you know, it comes down to that really, you know, that one thing about transparency. Mm-hmm. So if you can't sit down and have an honest conversation with someone, you're not being transparent with them. Mm-hmm. And that for us was just the key to everything. We hung our hats for so many years about, you know, that, you know, Index Exchange was transparent. This was obviously something that we did that was out of step with how we promote or how we were informing our clients of changes within our platform. And that's something we're now more attuned to, and we're going to be ensuring that moving forward everything is, you know, completely documented and shared accordingly. We've done an amazing amount of work last year on you know, building out our knowledge base and ensuring that the customers actually have everything at their fingertips that they could want and need. So from that point of view, there's definitely been a lot more of an inwards focus on ensuring that documentation and transparency is just part and parcel of everything that we do.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, like it was just that one piece was not. And it's an interesting thing. You know, there was an article, I think, in DigiDay towards the end of last year around like, well, if it was perceived, like if you took it as a, you know, a tech company innovating, How do we continue to innovate as technology if, you know, everything is transparent?
Yeah.
And that's something, you know, we're not going to shy away from. We will continue to innovate and we'll just make sure that we're very transparent and open about it. And if it means that we're innovating not for, you know, our own clients' benefits, but if we're innovating for the market and the industry and the ecosystem as a whole, then everyone's winning in the end.
Mm. Yep. And I guess having sort of gone through that experience, it gives you a bit more confidence around the notion of transparency and accountability.
Absolutely.
What is that? Has that done anything to, you know, what about sort of industry initiatives? We mentioned before, you know, that you're involved in the trade desks. What's it called again?
Oh, the Unified ID
That's
solution.
That's it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Does it, I mean, from a sort of, industry point of view, are there some initiatives that are going on that you think are, you know, not just really good for sort of solving challenges, but also that's kind of grouped under the banner of transparency, accountability, open conversations, doing things for the benefit, wider benefit of the industry?
Yeah, I think that doesn't necessarily tie into the identity piece, but it does in some ways.
Yeah.
Not a direct one-to-one, but in some ways like
a different lane.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, if we look at identity for us in the space that we play is around really removing the competitive edge that our the more global platforms have around data.
Yes.
So we talked about obviously the usage of data with Facebook and the Weather Channel and those guys. Mm. Sorry, was it Weather Channel or Weather.com?
Yes, Weather Channel.
Thank you. Yep. I always get the two confused.
Yep.
So there is a lot of value for advertisers to continue to, you know, run with what they know. If we can provide a scalable solution, and this is the identity piece, you know, where they can leverage their own first-party data, advertisers' first-party data, so, you know, whether that's a bank understanding their user user journey and at what point will they flip from a credit card to a home loan and things like that, they can apply that at scale in the programmatic world, that's really powerful. Mm-hmm. And it provides that sort of jump off point for the shift to happen. We've seen a lot of investment. I think it was one of the key bets we made actually before I started. We started investing in what identity could look like.
Yep.
And built out a solution within our wrapper product that provides that. But for us in that transparency piece, it's about choice. So we have the integration with the trade desk. DigiTrust.
Yes. DigiTrust. Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you. That
yeah.
was the one that.
Yeah. 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 Which is sort of slightly spearheaded by
the IAB.
IAB.
Yeah. They acquired it. So obviously like the IAB initiative, what was originally the Advertising ID Consortium as well.
Yes.
So those three, again, if we offer that solution through the platform, you know, anyone can choose which one is the most relevant for their business.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It sounds like it's going to be a really exciting 2019, industry-wise and also for Index. So
yes.
I'm looking forward to having this conversation again in another 12 months and see where everything's at.
Any excuse to come back to us, huh?
Totally. Thanks so much, Adele, for joining me today.
And appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. And that was this week's MadTech Podcast.